When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to this Intelligence Squared election special with me, Jonathan Friedland. We are recording on November the 3rd, election day itself, for what is set to be a historic election, really, for not just the United States, but I think the entire world. It seems to me the entire world is biting its nails and watching this election. And to help us talk through it and maybe even have a kind of mutual therapy session to help us understand what's at stake, I'm delighted to introduce our guest for this conversation. She is the Professor of American Literature and Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of London here in the UK, and she is the author of Behold America, A History of America First and the American Dream. She is Sarah Churchwell. Sarah, how are you coping on this day of all days?
Well, I've been tweeting a lot and I'm glued to all of the, you know, different facts and reactions that people are sharing. There's been a lot of joking about alcohol in the not too distant future, which is only semi-joking. I think all of us are reliving 2016 pretty vividly. And I know how devastated I personally was by that outcome. So I actually think that my nerves were worse yesterday. I found yesterday really difficult. And I mean, like, personally difficult. And today it feels more like at last it's here and we're going to get this thing over with. And I, of course, that begs the question, which we'll probably talk about whether we're going to get this with today. But at least it's beginning.
Psychologically, I know what you mean. You almost, if it's an ordeal, you'd rather it starts.
The race has begun. So let's see.
I mean, I'm amazed and impressed that you're looking at Twitter. I've developed all these strategies for today, which is I'm really avoiding it. And I went for a little run this morning with, the podcast in my ear, but deliberately it was about Arsenal Football Club. I thought I can't take any more now of this sort of election stuff. It's partly that the sort of shouting is all over and now it is just the day.
Yeah, I think that's right. But, I'd say for a couple of things. One is that I'm at that state where I'm so obsessed with it that it's a wrench to try to talk about anything else or think about anything else. And I find that disturbing, but also that, I mean, it's just kind of overwhelming right now. So I kind of need to be overwhelmed by it. But also that the way that I've deliberately kind of set up Twitter as a source of information for me and as kind of curated information from experts that I trust. And so there are people who are filtering things for me and bringing in different perspectives, legal perspectives, political perspectives from, you know, serious pollsters. So I feel like that's helping me manage it. And it's certainly an illusion of control, but it's a very important psychological crutch right now.
Oh, no, I get that. My worry would be that what if one of your curated experts tells you something that your nerves can't bear to hear at this point? I mean, the example is the whole lot of people. Look, we should come clean. I mean, you already have. You want to see Trump lose. And I don't think I've made any secret in the stuff I've written for The Guardian that I'm in the same place. So we can be honest about that. But I had a sort of weekend freak out with this poll out of Iowa. Now, Iowa was not even a state that people were hoping or dreaming that Democrats could win. But when this poll suddenly suggested a big shift to Donald Trump, he was 7 points ahead in a survey done by a polling company who had previously had him more or less level or even behind. You know, it just, the sort of nerves were shredded. So even though they, it was reputable people who were passing on this data to me, it was all my finely curated Twitter feed, it still was enough to have me in shreds over the weekend, which is why, as a matter of personal health, I've made today different.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's funny because we're clearly in exactly the same boat there. But in my case, the instant thing that I had to do was to go find out, and this is cognitive bias, but I had to go find out why the Seltzer poll, which, as you say, is a gold standard poll in Iowa. But it was like, this can't be right. Like, this just can't be right. And so, but also it was, all kidding about cognitive bias aside, it was actually trying to understand how that poll could account for what was a 23-point shift among independents in a month from September to the end of October. Which, so there's a part of that at which we all just as you know, observers on our own, you know, judgment have to go, we either buy a 23-point shift among independents or we don't, and we recognize that polls are predictive mechanisms but not absolute and all of those things. So it was kind of like finding all of the mechanisms that would enable me to cope with that particular poll. Absolutely.
I mean, with you, it's interesting because your field is American literature, and of course it does range wider into American society, but you know, you're not a sophologist, nor am I, and yet suddenly you can go right into the weeds there about kind of polling methodologies. It's something about this contest that has sort of forced, it's made sophologists of all of us as an outlet, really, in a way, for neurotic energy, don't you?
Yeah, exactly, right? That's what I mean. It is a psychological crutch that we're kind of claiming or not even claiming expertise we don't have, but trying to master all of this information, disinformation, misinformation, distortion, and noise, just trying to find some way of making sense of it in our own heads. And yes, I come at this from a background in literature, although, as you say, I've been working actually on American cultural history for a long time. But that also means that I'm really sensitive to narrative, and that this is about trying to construct narratives very consciously that. And, you know, all of my work is really about the importance of context for determining meaning. There is no meaning without context, which everybody knows on a kind of basic level, but we often don't think about what that means in terms of the ways we talk about politics or history or culture. And that's really my kind of research focus and interest. And this is all just a way of creating contexts for ourselves. We need to contextualize this information so we can make sense of it. And yeah, one of those is that suddenly we all have to become highly numerate in ways that we weren't.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think that's the point, is that people who previously didn't have to drill into this level of detail have, and people like you are now, you know, fully expert in the situation. Let's talk about election night as we both go into it. How you're yourself going to planet. I mean, what for you, have you decided in your mind what the kind of key moment is that once you hear that, then you kind of know what's going on? And we should say that it's an odd kind of election day because close to 100 million Americans have already voted as we go into it. It's not as if we can say this is the moment. It's already been the moment for weeks. But do you have, in terms of when the moment, that you know, the broadcast, first of all, which broadcast are you going to watch? What for you is the key hour? Are you going to sleep before or afterwards? Just talk us through your election night plan.
Okay. Well, my plan began with taking drugs last night so I could sleep. Legal over-the-counter drugs, I hasten to add, but because I wouldn't have slept otherwise, and I knew I needed to be able to go through today. So I don't plan to sleep tonight. I'm just going to go straight through it.
The disco nap between 7 p.m. and midnight? That's what I'm going for.
I don't think I'll be able to. I think I'll just be too hyper at that point, yeah. I mean, yeah. I might give it a whirl, you know. And we'll have to see how it goes and how the energy is feeling. But I always, since I've been based in the UK like you, I actually switch back and forth between different coverage because I find all of it a little bit inadequate from a distance. But the last election, I was watching CNN primarily, and I think that's probably where I'll land, but I'll be moving around. It might be MSNBC as well, but at least in 2016, CNN seemed to be the fastest. It seemed to be the most up-to-date over here in terms of cable coverage and stuff that I could keep up with. But I don't actually, so I'm just going to kind of bop around and see who I land on. But I'm also going to have that Twitter feed on in front of me and be, you know, watching what other people are saying about it. And in terms of the states to watch, I personally, we were just talking about this, you know, supernumeracy that we've all achieved. But I actually find it really helpful to use the visual trackers on the maps where you actually play around with the battleground states and work out pathways to victory that way, because it really helps me visualize how many, you know, you read that Biden has more pathways to victory than Trump has. But when you actually start, you know, saying, well, what happens if Biden takes Pennsylvania and Florida? And then you realize that Trump literally has to take every other battleground state. And even then, I think in that scenario, he can't quite get over the line. And so I think that we all know what the states are to watch. He's got Biden has, unless the polls are, you know, wildly out, much more out than they were in 2016. And as many pollsters have pointed out, they were within the margin of error in 2016. And they had not had robust polls in the kinds we were just talking about in Iowa. They had not had that kind of gold standard polling in the upper Midwest states that carried Trump over the line, the 77,000 votes he got in three upper Midwest states. Those states have now been deeply, carefully polled. And Biden is leading by somewhere between 8 and 15 points in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and at a similar range in New Hampshire. So unless those polls are wildly off, if we assume that Biden takes those, and he's also very far ahead by early vote counts in Nevada. So unless that is completely blown out of the water, then it does come down to the big states. It comes down to Pennsylvania. It comes down to Florida, potentially North Carolina and Georgia, both in play. Obviously, the more of them that go to Biden, the better it is. I think Pennsylvania is a must win for Trump numerically. You can see it mathematically. And it's clear that kind of it majorly increases both candidates' chances. So Pennsylvania is the first one I'm going to be watching. But of course, they may not call it quickly. If it's close, it may take Pennsylvania several days. And the other thing that I'm very conscious of and worried, bracing myself for, is the many warnings about the so-called red mirage. Because of the expectation that Trump voters are going to vote overwhelmingly in person today, and that Biden voters were overwhelmingly voting mail-in and absentee ballots, and those are taking longer to count, obviously, and may have to be counted after the election, which is why the Trump campaign is going after them and the local GOPs are going after those votes. So saying I'm going to be watching what happens in Pennsylvania tonight doesn't mean that I'll know what happens in Pennsylvania tonight. But if all of the major outlets call it for one or the other, then that's going to be a pretty clear indicator, and that should happen pretty early in the process.
I mean, it's the red mirage thing is a very, very good health warning for people that that some states could look more Republican at the beginning, and then that can sort of melt away. People are warning equally, though, down south, Florida, Arizona, Georgia could themselves have a blue mirage where they look more Democrat because there they will have totted up the early mail-in votes first. And so the early numbers might look really encouraging for Biden, and you could then see Trump sort of catching up, as it were, as the night goes on. I mean, it's interesting, this thing about Pennsylvania, and everyone is rightly sort of focusing on that. If, as I understand it, if Joe Biden gets one of what some people are calling the significant six, and I think that's Florida, Texas, North Carolina, Arizona, and you can throw in Iowa and Ohio, if he gets one of those, it's sort of game over, and we may not even have to get to sort of obsessing about Pennsylvania. In a way, I think the psychological test is if Florida goes to Trump and if Arizona goes to Trump, is somehow holding one's nerve for Pennsylvania. But people say the trouble with that is that then, because it takes so long, Donald Trump can try and get ahead of that by saying, well, obviously, I'm going to win Pennsylvania. I you know, I've won these other states. It's all over. I declare myself the victor. How do you think the American politics, in the sense of Republicans and congressional figures, governors, should handle and will handle that situation?
Well, how they should handle it is very different from how they will handle it. I think very, very clearly they've made their position on this all too clear. So you're absolutely right. That's exactly what he'll try to do. For me, in many ways, the worst case scenario is not even Trump having a clear win, although that would be a terrible scenario from my point of view, but is a knife edge where the results look like, and there are, you know, again, just sticking with those battleground states, there are distributions of those states where, you know, you end up with Trump at 269 electoral votes and, you know, Biden at, you know, 271 or something. And so it's basically a dead heat. And I think in many ways that would be the worst possible outcome, because all of those divisions will just get fomented. And because what it will do is it will start to normalize the idea that which Trump has been trying to do, to normalize the idea that American elections are decided in the courts. but American elections are not supposed to be decided in the courts. That is not what should be happening. And so to get to these battleground positions of, you know, as I say, of it really being balanced on a knife edge, we saw what happened in 2000 with that. We saw how bad that was for the country. And in my view, that damage has continued to divide the country, and the consequences of it are very real. I mean, there are not enough people, I think, are aware, particularly in Europe, that both Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett were judicially advising the GOP in that Florida recount in 2000. They have had a political position that is pro-GOP for those 20 years, and they helped convince the Supreme Court that it should halt the recount in Florida. So the consequences are real.
I think I read somewhere that it wasn't just Supreme Court judges, Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, but John Roberts
too.
As well.
It was so, Roberts, I mean, too. It was all three of them.
All three of them, yeah. So he's now in a different place and is seeming to occupy a sort of now a kind of centrist swing vote position potentially. But you're right, they all have that amazing sort of mud on their boots from the Florida battle.
And
yet we're asking
interest.
Them potentially now, to play referee. Just to take a step back for a second, I have been in my journalism and we both have, I think, in this conversation, been working on the assumption that this is an absolutely pivotal election for the United States and maybe for the wider world. And I just want to sort of substantiate that a bit. I mean, anybody who's covered American elections knows that the candidates always say this is the most important election of my lifetime and your lifetime. My sense is that it is this time. It's not just rhetoric, but let's hear you make the case for why this is.
Yeah.
First of all, let's do with America, and then we'll get on to the wider world.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think there's no question that it is. And I would argue that there is a strong case to be made that it's the most consequential presidential election in American history since 1796. And what happened in 1796, of course, is that George Washington decided not to run for a third term and to step down in order to establish the peaceful transfer of power, in order to establish that the presidency was not a monarchy. Since 1796, we have never had a president who didn't accept that principle until now. During wars, people will say this is as consequential as Lincoln's re-election in 1864. Yes, but Lincoln's opponent in 1864, the Democrat McClellan, accepted when he lost. And so we can argue consequential elections. 1968 was incredibly consequential. 2000, as we've just said, was incredibly consequential, not just for the United States, but for the world. You just have to pause and imagine what world history would look like if Gore had become president instead of W, right? The consequences for climate change are enormous. The consequences for the Middle East and for the refugee crisis and many of the things that we're dealing with right now are enormous. The ways in which the so-called war on terror, well, first of all, they wouldn't have called it a war on terror. And from there on out, the ways in which 9/11 would have been responded to in different ways. So it's almost unfathomable how different everything would be and how consequential that election turned out to be. So I'm not saying there haven't been other majorly important elections in U.S. history. But this one is unique in that regard. And it is unique in that for the first time, we do not have a presumption among both the president and his administration and among the American electorate that the outcome of the election will be peacefully accepted and that the loser will congratulate the winner. And that goes for the losing side of voters as well as the winning side of voters. And then we will accept the outcome and move on. I found I was doing some research actually about something else, but looking into newspaper coverage in 1936, and I stumbled on this kind of fascinating article about from the American press about Roosevelt's re-election in 1936. And it actually said, everybody's so worried about FDR's election and Democrats and Republicans. And then this editorial said, but at the end of the day, we will all, and it was exactly that language, said we will all congratulate the winner and we will move on. And then he said, and the moment that ceases to happen, the United States will cease to be a democracy. And I read that a couple of days ago and I thought, well, there is, from 1936 saying this is the key to democracy. And this is the first time that we've had an administration that was absolutely refusing to adhere to that principle. Now, will all of the GOP refuse to do that? That remains to be seen. What will the Senate do? I don't know. I don't know what McConnell would do in such a situation, but I don't trust him as far as I can throw him. But certainly, the evidence of what he's done so far is that he has absolutely no sense of of principle to the you know, to the Constitution. So,
and just tell us again, who was it in 1936 who issued that warning that if we don't,
it was an editor. I actually tweeted it, and I'll have to look it up. It was a local editorial. I want to say it was like in Wisconsin or something.
But what this goes to is the notion of loser's consent, and that is actually a crucial, perhaps as you've just suggested, the crucial aspect of a democracy, the consent of the loser. And one thing, it's interesting how this has been normalised. The one thing everyone is not expecting tonight, and people are not holding their breath for, is a concession speech from Donald Trump, even if it is a massive landslide, unambiguous win for Joe Biden. Nobody believes that Donald Trump will pick up that phone and call Joe Biden and then tell his supporters, "I wish the new president-elect luck."
Not going to happen. It's not conceivable. So that's part of the reason we started by saying that, you know, my nerves were worse yesterday. And part of what made my nerves yesterday was that I tried to imagine Trump just not even conceding, and certainly not graciously calling anybody, but just admitting that it was over and that he'd lost. And you simply can't conceive of it. It is inconceivable that Donald Trump, who we have watched closely for 4 years, would do that. So I found myself, you know, kind of taking refuge in, he has said at some of his rallies over the last few weeks, he has said things like, you know, "Can you imagine if I lose, I'll have to leave the country." So I found myself thinking that he's actually more likely to scuttle off. You know, a bit like the end, for those of you who know Philip Roth's Plot Against America, when Lindbergh just kind of flies away. Yeah. That I find that more conceivable, that he would literally just get on a plane overnight if it's clear that he's lost, and if the Republicans call him up, you know, behind the scenes and say, you know, "Game's up, it's over, you've lost," than him actually standing up and making the speech. I think he'd just run away.
I mean, this breaks one of my vows, which is not to allow myself to imagine this scenario, because it's sort of super, I don't want to jinx it, and it's getting too far ahead now. But it is a fascinating thing. There is a 3-month transition period in the US system, and it's very hard to imagine. You know, the text I always think of here is the letter that George Herbert Walker Bush left on the desk of the incoming president, his successor, Bill Clinton. Which is it's a genuinely moving note. It's a very short note, but he says, essentially, "You're my president now, and I'm going to be rooting for you to do well. Your success is our success." The idea of Donald Trump writing that note, I can't even conceive of it. But this morning, of all people, Nigel Farage put out a little film of himself walking the streets of Washington, D.C., noticing how many shops and stores and banks were boarded up. And he said this is because they're bracing themselves for violence. If Donald Trump were to lose, and if he were to not give the concession speech, which we've both said we don't expect, what cue does that send? And what would be the reaction, do you think, among his supporters? And I'll just slip in there that image a lot of us saw this week of the Biden-Harris bus going through Texas being essentially like a scene out of that early Steven Spielberg film Duel, you know, being kind of driven off the road. Farage is suggesting there will be violence implicitly in that film of his. What do you think?
Well, I want to say two things about Farage first, before I answer that question. The first is that he said that he thought it would be violence on the left. He was saying it would be Antifa violence.
Absolutely. Good point.
So, yeah. You know, which I think is really important there, because he's trying to say that it will only come from the left. And the pictures have gone around this morning also of the White House surrounded by barricades, and people have been saying, you know, he couldn't build a wall on the Mexican border, but he managed to build a wall around the White House. And again, for the first time in American history, right? I mean, this just doesn't happen. I mean, we didn't even build a wall against the British when you guys came and burned it down in 1812, for heaven's sake, or the war.
You kind of regret that. I can hear the pain.
Right? Exactly.
Still not over it.
But the other thing that I'll say about Farage is that he has been unexpectedly one of the things that's given me hope in the last 24 hours, because I don't think he would have announced his little reform party if he thought he was going to get anywhere in the United States. If he thought Trump was going to win, he'd be over there still sucking up relentlessly to try to get a job with Trump. So I think that his decision to return to his political fortunes in the UK bodes well for the US, if not for the UK. The to the question of violence, it's a very, very, very real possibility. As you say, it's already happening. So is it it's a reality. I don't think there's any point in talking about it as a hypothetical. We're seeing it happen. The question is how entrenched that violence will get. Will it just be sporadic? And will it just be some militias, shooting off their guns? But we've gotten to the point where we've got an administration that is justifying. Armed militias are illegal in every one of the 50 states. And we have an administration that is, and we've all seen it, that is encouraging them and is, as Farage was doing, insisting that all the violence is on the left and fomented on the left when we can all see that it's white supremacist violence on the right. There were pictures over the weekend of protesters in front of Barr's house, Attorney General Barr, and they were protesting that they didn't think that the Trump administration was doing enough to stop the left. And Barr went out there and like gave them coffee and chatted with them, although they were like armed militia in front of his house, you know? So all of that says to me that violence is a very real possibility. If anything, my concern would be that the left might roll over before it. Now, that might sound flippant, as if I'm saying I want armed conflict in the streets, and obviously nobody sane wants that. But is it a viable possibility? Of course it is. And, the other thing that I say this a lot, but I think it is worth thinking about, that any country that calls itself the United States is really protesting too much, and that the divisions are the reality, and that these rhetorical moves are there to try to pull us back together again. But we have had several civil wars. The American Revolution was a civil war. It was brother against brother. It was family member who were loyalists against family members who were revolutionaries. 75 years later, we had the Civil War. The Vietnam conflict led to bombs and riots across the country in 68 and in the early 70s, violence, and really serious violence in ways that I think people have forgotten. So the reality of armed conflict, unfortunately, in the United States is a historical fact, and we've actually never gone very long without it. So again, I hope it's clear to everybody listening, I'm in no way making light of that. And I'm in no way saying that I think, we should, just pass it over lightly. But do I think it's a real possibility in the coming weeks? Absolutely, I think it is.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared. And to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
I mean, I want us to get to the rest of the world. We must do that in a moment. But just before we leave this, I mean, do you spend a lot of time thinking about the 40, 41, 42% which polls say are going to vote for Donald Trump, despite, as you would see it, and I would too, everything that's happened over these last 4 years, even despite the handling of the pandemic, despite some of the sort of gross remarks, the sort of personally gross things he does and says? What do you think explains that resilience of that vote? And I suppose, in a way, if he does lose, the kind of grief they're going to feel, the sort of loss that group of people will feel if he, this man they have sort of become so attached to, loses.
Yeah. I'm afraid, this might make me sound callous and unfeeling. I'm not going to spend a lot of time worrying about their feelings, because it isn't clear that sympathy and compassion is reciprocated. And they have, as Adam Serwer famously said in his essay in The Atlantic a couple of years ago, they have gotten off on the cruelty of Trump, that the cruelty is the point. And his cruelty to the people they see as their victims and their opponents is the point. So those people who relish that cruelty, I'm not actually going to spare them much compassion. Now, that's a different thing from thinking about how we as a democratic polity need to try to come back together. And I think we do need to try to find common ground. We absolutely have to rebuild. First, we have to just outvote them. The thing is they're a minority, right? So that 42%, so at the moment, we're in a minoritarian rule position, which is just untenable for anything that calls itself a democracy, but for particularly for such a large one as the United States. It simply just disenfranchises too many people and in a very dramatic way, right? So that the policies of the current GOP are wildly off track with the voting preferences of the vast majority of the American electorate. So things like gun control, abortion, reproduction rights, the big hot ticket issues, healthcare. The Democrats' positions on those issues is very, very much in track with the vast majority of the population, and the Republicans are outliers. So, you know, the democracy is not going to hold if you don't have a representative government that actually represents the views of the people. So I think we have to get to that point first where there is more of a matchup, where we're not in the situation where it's just the setup of the United States is an 18th century republic that is trying to act more like a democracy. So we've got to figure out from within ways for it to become more democratic in its representationalness, or whatever the right word is, representativeness, in its ability to represent a larger proportion of the American people. And then what do? We work on education and we work on dismantling propaganda, because the thing that has held the 42% together is propaganda. There was we were talking about the polls over the weekend, and there was a really interesting New York Times 538 piece about the ways in which new voters are coming to that it's a new electorate, basically, because people who didn't vote in 2016, people who've never voted in their lives, old voters who are literally coming out for the first time. And then they were also interviewing some Trump supporters, of course. And there was one that just hit me where this woman said she was going to vote for Trump again because he never lies. And I just thought, you know, you're dealing there with somebody whose willful blindness and their cognitive bias is so intense that they think that Donald Trump never lies when he's told 22,000 lies while he's been in office. And there was some poll or other recently, that you'll know who it was, that found that he's literally the biggest liar in the world. Literally nobody has lied more than this man. And there's a supporter insisting that he doesn't lie. So until we get to the point where we don't have supporters saying that black is white and up is down and day is night, I'm afraid we simply have to outvote them. And then, as I say, we have to get back to trying to reclaim the common ground of factuality. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You've just completed that point.
The point about factuality, right, is the point that that historians of authoritarianism and totality, I mean, it's the point that Arendt makes in The Origins of Totalitarianism, and she makes it again in her great essay on America, on the politics of lying, when she responded to the Pentagon Papers in the early 70s. And she basically says, you know, you don't have democracy without shared consensual ideas about facts, and you need trustworthy people telling you what the facts are, because that's how your political system comes together. And that's clearly what is being deliberately damaged in the United States. And, you know, I would argue in the UK as well, but that might be another conversation for another day.
That certainly is. Your point about the people saying he's honest really strikes a chord. When I was covering the campaign in 2016, and again, actually interviewing Trump supporters earlier this year, they repeatedly go back to this point about him being honest. And either it's some psychological thing of saying, you know, flipping the very, turning his weakness into a strength, or I think it must be that on some level, the sense is that he's not truthful factually, but he's honest in the sense of the underlying truth. The underlying truth being that all these other people are evil and we're good and that our country has been stolen from us. I think that must be what they mean. The very last thing, because we're all running out of time, is the wider world. I mean, obviously, people all over the world have become obsessed about this election. Is there something massive at stake for people who live in Lisbon and Liverpool and Lima in this election, as well as for people who live in Louisville or Lexington?
How very alliterative. Yes, I...
Yeah, I just pulled those out. I didn't plan
it. That was good. That's, it was impressive.
I'm pleased.
Absolutely. I like a pattern. Listeners will have to judge for themselves. Obviously, I'm biased here. As an American who lives abroad, I'm going to think that this has massive consequences for everyone. But I think that it does. And again, we can just name a couple of the ways when we talked about the consequences from the 2000 election, climate change. I mean, simply the issue of climate change, simply the issue of, none of them are simple issues, right? But I mean, the biggest issues that we face. As someone living in Britain and with an eye on what's happening in Ireland, I'm very conscious of the fact that Biden and Pelosi are very clear that they will do no trade deals that will jeopardize the Good Friday Agreement. So, you know, those are two really prominent examples where the difference is going to be profound. And then we can multiply those out. But in terms of just security and stability, in terms of regrouping about what factuality looks like, in terms of having a leadership that actually, you know, will criticize Putin, imagine that idea again, and will hold lines against him, will reinforce the importance of the strategic alliances, particularly with NATO, that will not just suck up to strongmen and bullies around the world, that will go back to empiricism, to evidence-based thinking. And I haven't even mentioned the pandemic. The consequences for the pandemic are immense unless you actually close American borders and stop them from traveling. Even if the rest of the country gets this under control, the United States is going to keep spreading it. It's going to be the super spreader of the world. So it turns out we need science. And it turns out that with all due respect to people of faith, religion ain't enough. We need science, and we need an administration that believes in science, so and believes in contracts, that doesn't just break contracts. So you need to know, as a country that is making deals with another major power in the world, that they are, you know, the leadership can be trusted to stick to the deals, and that's crucial for. That's crucial for the economy. That's crucial for, international investment and global movement of money. You have that. We need that for the security of currencies. You know, I mean, all of that stuff is real, and people are acting as if it just kind of, regulates itself, and it doesn't. And the destabilizing that we've seen in the last 4 years has been profound. But it will go off the charts if Trump gets back in.
So huge amounts of stake at stake for the world, obviously for the United States itself. I was going to say, I'll let you get some sleep. You're not going to be able to get any. You're too wired. And so am I. And so is everyone else. Thank you so much, Sarah Churchwell, for this conversation. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.